yay, oh yay.
The Honorable Court of Appeal for the Second District of Texas is now in session.
You can be seated, thank you. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We're glad you're here this morning. We have one case that's going to be heard, and it's my understanding that the parties are all here and ready. Before we begin, I'd like to introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Mike Wallach, and to my left is Justice, Brian Walker. And I'm Bonnie Sitterth, I'm the Chief of the Court. Before we begin the argument, I'll ask the clerk to please call the case.
The court will now call number 02-25-132-CB, City of Forest Hill and Richard Winters versus Lena Nino. May it please the court, Mr. James T. Jeffrey Jr. will argue for appellants, and Mr. Tim D. Newsom will argue for appellants.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Tim Jeffrey. I represent the appellant, City of Forest Hill, and Sergeant Winters. There's a lot of ground to cover, and I think it would make sense to focus on whether this is a governmental or proprietary function, and then I think that will inform the court as to the other issues that we raised in our appellant's briefing. This accident happened during a training exercise in which Sergeant Winters and Officer Mino were both participating as police officers. It's an active shooter training, and it's required by Occupations Code Section 1701.3525. I think that's very important, that it's something that the state requires.
And it was post Uvalde, right? I mean, this was kind of
part of
the training battery that was created in response to that.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
But don't you see a distinction between the requirement that there be training and the requirement that you provide training? Your officers have to be trained.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the training is required.
Yes,
but there's no requirement that the City of Forest Hill actually do the providing of the training. They can contract out with some other party.
Well, that is true, Your Honor. And yesterday, and I apologize for the tardy notification, but I found this court's Doe versus City of Fort Worth case, and a similar issue was raised in that case. And this court held that the governmental functions can be performed by the entity itself, employees of the entity, or they can hire contractors to perform the function, or even use volunteers. And in the Doe case, that's what happened. Volunteer was involved in committing the horrific tort.
Is that was that at a, like a dog facility or like a?
It was a dog rescue facility, and the person supervising the 15-year-old girl sexually abused her.
Right.
And this court held that that was a governmental function, and the volunteer, unfortunately, that was abused during this volunteer activity still was subject to being the requirements of the Tort Claims Act because it was a governmental function.
Well, I mean, so I understand that piece, that this was a volunteer and we held that, but you do have an interesting situation where you have the city, who's not necessarily specifically required to do this training, and it's my understanding they're already getting a certain amount of money I believe from the state to train the officers.
Yes.
But then at the same time, it seems that they're using this as kind of a money-making venture for the city so that they can solicit officers from all these other municipalities and jurisdictions and charge them a fee.
Well, Your Honor, even if that is true, and of course we're going just by what the pleadings assert, this court cited with approval the Butler versus City of San Antonio case involving a drunkard at the Alamo Dome who fell off an upper deck and seriously injured somebody that he fell on. And the City of San Antonio made money from operating the Alamo Dome. They made money from liquor sales, and they had an independent contractor providing the liquor. And so because the court concluded that it was a governmental function, those were irrelevant to determining, excuse me, whether or not it was a governmental function. And so again, assuming that we have here the city working with a private contractor to provide training, you can't lose sight of the fact that police officers have to have training to function as a police officer. You can't get a license and you can't keep your license unless you have training. The state furnishes money for the training. The state requires the police departments to make sure that the officers are trained and report the training to the state.
Sure.
And so with those factors being considered, looking at the Butler and San Antonio case and the Doe case here, there's no doubt that this is a governmental function. It's part of police protection. The Tort Claims Act requirement listing governmental functions as police protection and control. And you can't provide police protection and control if the officers aren't certified, and to get certification and keep it, you have to have training.
And so you would say that, you know, in other words, officers cannot do their job in protecting and serving unless they're adequately trained.
Yes, sir.
And if they're and it doesn't matter who's paying for it, where the money's coming from, any of that stuff. If it's any kind of training exercise, that's your position, correct?
Yes.
That it's automatically it's definitely not proprietary. It is a governmental function.
Yes, Your Honor. And to that point, I want to clarify, not just any training. It has to be TCOL, Texas Commission on Law Enforcement, TCOL approved training. And so that's what we have here. The plaintiff asserted that this was a TCOL approved course, had TCOL assigned number, and it's a state mandated type of training for active shooter response training. And further, and we cited this in our briefing, I can't quote the statutes and regulations off the top of my head. I've got them written down here somewhere, but the state not only mandates training on active shooters, but requires training on use of force, and there's firearms proficiency that the officers have to go through. This was certainly a tragic accident that occurred, but both of the participants, Officer Mino and Sergeant Winters, were participating in training. Sergeant Winters was in the role of the active shooter as a trainee, and the unfortunately, Officer Mino was the, they call him in police world, bad guy, and officer
was handed the firearm.
Yeah, and was handed, unfortunately, Sergeant Winters was handed a live firearm by the course instructors. And so again, looking at this as a governmental function, the statute describes police protection and control as a governmental function. If you look to the general definition, even more broadly, under section 101.0215 subpart A, and not even getting to the laundry list of what is a defined governmental function, there's three factors. One is it's enjoined on the municipality by law. Two is it's given to the municipality by the state as part of the state's sovereignty, and it's to be exercised by the municipality in the interest of the general public. The general public certainly wants its police officers trained and certified, and it's important that police officers in certain circumstances have jurisdiction statewide, and that's if a felony is committed in their presence or a breach of the peace. They can take enforcement action. Police officers have jurisdiction outside of their home city if they're within the same county and see certain traffic infractions. So we don't want officers who are not trained to be performing statewide, potentially. So it is, any training an officer receives, any certification they get, is for the benefit of the general public. So under the broad definition of what is a governmental function, it meets those criteria, the training does. It's enjoined on the municipality by law, this mandatory training. The state must receive reports that the officers have complied with the training. The state furnishes money for training. It's certainly in the general interest of the general public to have these officers trained. Your Honor, just using the Uvalde tragedy as an example, officers from multiple jurisdictions, including federal officers, responded to that scene. You know, we certainly aren't here about federal officers, but officers from outside the city, the county, and even, I believe, neighboring counties responded to that scene. And so, again, training certainly is something that has statewide benefit and is a benefit to the general public. So it's clear that under the broad definition of a governmental function, this training is a governmental function.
Going back to the fee issue, the fact that the city was charging a fee, did you cite a Dallas case that was on point with this issue, if I remember right, or at least Dallas case on point, that somewhat on point?
Well, the only case I can recall where there was an issue about money getting in the city's benefit was the Butler case, the drunkard at the Alamo Dome. If there is a Dallas case, I'm certainly overlooked it. But again, in the Butler case, that was not relevant to determining if it was a governmental function. And that leads to the next issue in this case is Sergeant Winter's request for dismissal. It was made by him and on his behalf by the city under Rule 91A. If this is a governmental function, there is no doubt that he has statutory immunity under Section 101.106, several subparts, A, E, and F, as to any claim against him in his individual capacity. And this court even held in the Texas Bay Cherry Hill case that we cited throughout the briefing that when somebody pleads in the alternative, I'm suing the employee as an individual, I'm also suing him in his official capacity, that it doesn't matter, that there is still a mandated dismissal under Tort Claims Act Section 101.106E, subpart E. And in the case here, the plaintiff pleads that Sergeant Winters was acting at all times in his capacity as employee of the city. She contends he was acting as a police officer, and this court can certainly recognize, regardless of whether those pleadings or the admissions in the pleadings were set forth, that a police officer participating in a training officer exercise that he's required to participate in is engaged in performance of his duties, scope of duties.
The trial court, you know, in your briefing, you basically say that the trial court must, or I guess you could just say just clearly, found that this was proprietary, but also at the same time, I think in your briefing you pointed out that the trial court did not give us findings, right? She never actually said what her rationale was in ruling in the way that she did and denying
correct
summary judgment.
And there's body of cases that, again, I don't recall off the top of my head, that recognize that a court implicitly overrules a position by taking or issuing a ruling that's contrary to the asserted arguments. Otherwise, you know, we'd have an issue about whether there is or isn't a jurisdiction over an interlocutory appeal.
And there's really only two conclusions you can reach on this issue.
I mean, yes, Your Honor.
So if yes, it wasn't governmental, then it was proprietary, essentially. Yeah.
Yes.
And I think vice versa.
Yes, Your Honor. I think what's important to recognize is Sergeant Winter's motion was presented under Rule 91A. And 91A is clearly intended to result in early disposition of a challenge to a case based on an argument that it's groundless for whatever reason, either factually, legally, or both.
But the rule doesn't say a challenge to a case. It says challenge to a cause of action. Do you agree that the 1983 causes of action were not in the pleadings prior to the amendment 3 days before trial, 3 days before the hearing?
Yes, Your Honor. And
so hang on a second. So how can you challenge a cause of action which hasn't been made?
Your Honor, the case law that we cited, and we cited at least four cases in the briefing, and there are numerous other cases, mostly unpublished, that if the pleading that's presented on a timely basis has not been amended or withdrawn, then the court must rule on the 91A motion as of the time of the hearing. And therefore, because the only cause of action timely asserted was a tort cause of action, the proper ruling for the court should have been dismiss all claims against Sergeant Winters. And the cases that the plaintiff cited dealing with, yes, you can, the argument that, yes, you can add a Section 1983 claim, were cases written under rule, I'm sorry, the statute, 101.106. They were not section, they were not cases under Rule 91A, which has strict deadlines. And the cases that we cite in the briefing, including at least two from this court, the Hall versus Mansfield ISD and Teal versus AutoNation cases, both of those cases state that the court can't consider an untimely amendment.
Well, let's assume that the 1983 additions were timely. Then would your answer to Judge Wallach's question then be that you cannot essentially attack a cause of action if it hasn't been included at that point?
If the 1983 amendment was timely, I would not be making this argument.
Okay.
But I believe under Rule 91, as written, 91A, that if, because there's a strict procedure, we have to get the motion on file within 60 days of the date my clients are served. And although the rule says it's supposed to be ruled on within 45 days of my time's out.
You can finish your sentence.
Do you agree? Okay.
You can ask a question, sure.
Do you agree that in a 91A motion, the person challenging the causes of action doesn't have to challenge all causes of action? They can pick and choose, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if that's the case, how can you have a situation where if someone has a cause of action that they did not challenge, and then regardless of whether they challenged it or not, it has to be dismissed if the other part has to be challenged, correct?
No, that's not correct. If I can answer your question, assuming that there had been multiple causes of action asserted against Sergeant Winters, if he wanted to challenge all of them, he could. If he didn't challenge a timely asserted cause of action, then he can't complain that it wasn't dismissed. But that's not what we have here. We have one cause of action timely asserted in the third amended petition, which was plaintiff's fourth bite at the apple. And that cause of action was challenged, and it was not, there was no timely amendment to add a new cause of action. So the court has to rule on what was presented on a timely basis. And the only cause of action that was timely should have been dismissed, and therefore the whole case against Sergeant Winters should have been dismissed. If that answers your question, and I am out of time. I'd happy to continue if you need me to, but otherwise I've used more of my time than allowed it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The city's conduct in co-hosting, marketing, advertising, and we believe profiting from a active shooter training course in conjunction with a private company is a proprietary function, because the actual providing of the training is not essential to the governmental function of providing police protection. The key is whether providing the training is essential to the governmental function. True, the officers need their training. We all want them to have their training. This takes it a little bit step farther. And I want to address actually the Doe case that two of the justices, one of the chief justices, were part of that opinion, and also the City of San Antonio versus Butler case. Because here's the distinction between those cases and this case. Start with the Alamo Dome, the City of San Antonio case. In that case, the city was running a convention center, and it was promulgated to do that. To effectuate running the convention center, they had to contract with vendors and other contractors. This happened to be an alcohol vendor. Patron got intoxicated, fell, somebody got hurt. But to effectuate, to perform their essential service, their governmental function in that case, they had to contract with an outside provider. Same with the Doe case. Horrible facts. Everyone would agree with that. It's at an animal shelter. But to effectuate and run an animal shelter, this city had to contract with employees and people to come and work there. They had to. It's incumbent upon them. It was essential. Now, we contrast that with some of the cases we've cited, one of which is the Dallas case that Justice Walker, you may have been alluding to. That's the City of Dallas versus Aaron's case. And in that case, a police officer was killed in the line of duty. There were donations made for that officer, and they were sent to the city because probably they didn't know where else to send them. So the city formed a department to handle those funds, and there was a misappropriation of funds. And in that case, the Dallas Court of Appeals said that this was handling these funds for this officer was not essential to performing police services. Another case that we cite, it's an older case, but the older I get, and I heard this one as a young lawyer, and I guess maybe this isn't the forum to say it. They may be oldies, but they're goodies. And that's in the case I'm talking about, and that would be the City of Houston versus Schilling case, which may be a
Justice Birdwell would appreciate that.
And the Schilling case may be actually a closer factual analogy than the Aaron's case, maybe. And in that case, the city, of course, had the governmental function to provide garbage disposal, and they had garbage trucks. And so they decided, well, let's form our own garbage truck repair shop, and they did. And the garbage trucks were repaired. Garbage truck that was repaired had a crash. Someone got hurt, alleged that sued the city because the repairs were negligent or faulty, and that's what led to the crash. In that case, the Supreme Court said that it was outside the governmental function and was not essential to the governmental function, and held that, in fact,
the repairs or the operation of the vehicle?
Your Honor, I believe it was related to the fact that they were running the repairs and not the actual operation of the vehicle. I believe, but I would have to reread that opinion to be sure.
Yeah, I mean, on that specific question. I'm kind of hung up on how you started all of your argument, and that is, okay, you have a governmental function, and then whatever is done under that governmental function has to be necessary to that governmental function. And so I think what you're saying is that police training is a governmental function, but a particular type of training has to be necessary for that governmental function, and this wasn't. Is that your position?
No, Your Honor, if I may.
Yeah, sure.
Correct. We agree that training is essential to perform the governmental function of police protection. And within that training, there will be types of trainings that are required by the state. That post-Uvalde, there are certain types. The requirement for certain types of training would, in fact, be a governmental function. Where we take a step away from it is this particular city, the City of Forest Hills, then co-hosted, advertised, marketed, profited, we've alleged and hope to prove, this training. That takes them a step away from what is actually required of the city to do to provide its governmental function. So I agree that the type of training would fit under the umbrella. I think it has to. But when you take a step away and you start to go with a private contractor to promote, co-host, advertise, et cetera, you do those things, it takes you outside, because at that point, you as a city being a co-host, an advertiser, a marketer, that is not essential to you making sure your officers have the training.
Your oldie but goodie case, I think in dicta, or at least somewhere in the opinion, they talk about, you know, at some point, you know, you can have the government doing a lot of things. They could, you know, have a maintenance shop, and then the maintenance truck could go out and drive on the streets, and then the maintenance worker could end up picking up trash, and then at some point the trash guy could start delivering the mails, whatever. And you just keep doing all these things that's kind of being paid for by the government. But I think the language in the case said at some point it stops being a governmental function. It has to. That you know, just because the government's doing it, obviously, that it's not got all governmental functions when it comes to sovereign immunity. But, you know, where I struggle is, and I think this is the problem with the case law, is where is that arbitrary line? You know, at what point do we say, okay, this is proprietary, this is governmental?
That is, it is, as an old con law professor used to say, how far do they go?
Yeah.
And that's, and we used to make fun of him saying that, and I'm standing up here, I don't have an answer for this, and I'm certainly not making fun of any of this at all, but this came up in preparation, is how far do they go? And so the reason I started in talking about the Butler, the Alamo Dome case, and the Doe case is that in both of those cases, I thought, okay, you know, particularly one where two of the three panel members were on that opinion. How do we distinguish that case from where we are today?
And how do you do it?
and the way I've tried to come up with, whether it's persuasive or not, is to perform that governmental function, they had to hire employees, and unfortunately they hired someone they shouldn't have hired. But they did. They hired that person, and that person committed those horrible acts. Same with Alamo Dome. They had to perform their governmental function.
They could argue that in order to do this police training that was necessary, it was clearly necessary at this point, they've got to hire people, and they've got to have volunteers, and they've got to have participants in the exercise.
They can argue that, and what my response would be, Justice Walker, is they can also say, look, here are these TCOL classes. They're certified. They're approved. Go sign up for your class. We're going to pay for it. We've got money to pay for it, and they do. But they don't take hands-on in marketing, advertising, and co-sponsoring the program. That would be the difference in where that line gets crossed, as the Schilling case would put it, is the difficult question.
Was there anything in the record that lent itself to the idea that the whole reason that they did this, that the city did this, was for the benefit of making money? I mean, we know that municipalities can sometimes, I mean, speed traps are the perfect example. They'll increase a certain governmental function because it's good for the coffers, right? And you kind of allude to that, it seems like, that this was the whole purpose that they were doing was to, that's why they're charging a fee. But was there ever any really proof that that was really their motive?
There is not. Now, and if I may, this, I'm well aware I need to stay within the record, and certainly Mr. Jeffrey has a chance to respond. But we've, as far as depositions go with the city of Forest Hill, we've only taken the deposition of the officer. And then we've got the 91A motion, which is based on the pleadings. And so the next step would be to try to develop that testimony. So the direct answer, Justice Walker, is no, there is not. There are allegations in the pleading, and that's as far as it goes.
So what you're saying, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there's a distinction here, and that while the municipality is required to have trained officers, they're required by law to have trained officers, they are not required by law to provide that training.
That is true. And in one of the cases that the city cites, they talk about that training was within the definition of providing law enforcement, as I recall. I can't remember the name of the case right off my head, top of my head, but it is a footnote in that case. And in that particular case, the footnote out of the Code of Criminal Procedure defines law enforcement as training. So we don't have that phraseology in the Tort Claims Act. And so I would say that they're not required to
do the providing.
Correct, to the extent we've alleged that they have, for example, in this case where they've advertised, this is not a program that was just for City of Forest Hill. For example, Officer Mino was from Samson Park, so it was broadcasted out through the broker or through the promoter that's involved in the case too. So they don't have to provide the providing of it, But I think this one goes a step farther than that, Chief Justice Southworth, in that they advertised it, they marketed it, they charged a fee was charged for it, and that's what makes it even go a step farther than, for example, if the city were to come in and say, well, this was, we did this in the cafeteria of our police department, or in, you know, we did this in-house down the street at a building. This case is different from that. So I can see where
it was at a school.
It was at a school. That's correct. It was at a school. But if it was a pure in-house, we're going to watch it during lunch, we're going to learn, that type of training and providing training would probably be what is different from this case.
In other words,
and may get closer.
Okay, let me slightly change it then. So is it your position that while they're required to have trained officers, they're not required to provide training to other municipalities' officers?
That I would agree with that proposition. Yes, Your Honor.
This constable from Johnson County, the Gamond, or however you say his name, did I remember that he had a company, that there was a company formed, and that was also one of the defendants in this case?
There is a company formed that's one of the defendants in this case that hired Gamond to come in and do the training.
So there was, the city was doing this, that's your position, but they also hired a company to help them do this.
Yes, there was collaboration between the company, Texas Police Trainers is the name of the company, and a lady, Miss Washington, Janice Washington, is the owner of that company. Miss Washington and Texas Police Trainers would market out to, frankly, to smaller police departments, because they may not have all this in-house. And again, that's getting the field. But they would market, and that's what happened here with Forest Hill. Then they co-sponsored. And I'm not aware of any evidence, and it may have been loosely alleged in the pleadings, but the relationship with Officer Gamond, the trainer, would have been effectuated, as best we can tell so far, with Texas Police Trainers.
Who was getting the fee?
Texas Police Trainers would be paid the fee. And then the question would be, how is that fee then divided up among them all? And that's not an area we've been able to delve into at this stage on 91A.
So you really don't know from the record if the city was the beneficiary of that fee that was being collected?
We don't know at this time.
Right.
We don't. Justice Wallach, you raised, if I could, so it's our position that this was a proprietary function. Now, Justice Wallach, you raised the question on the timing of the filing of the 1983 amendment and the 91A motion.
And the reason I asked asked that question, I don't recall seeing either side briefing the Texas Department of Aging versus Cannon case, Supreme Court case from 2015, which talks about the fact that claims which are not subject to the Tort Claims Act, specifically 1983 claims, can be filed according to the general rules of pleading and the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure. Didn't have a 91A claim in that case, but since the 91A claim here is being moved to be dismissed because of the Tort Claims Act, it seems to me there's an interplay between the two which we have to take into consideration.
Yes, and knowing Mr. Jeffrey and I both, we probably will ask the court to write a short. I won't speak for him. One time I got in trouble for saying, a lawyer saying, don't presume to know what I, to speak for me, and so I won't speak for him, but we may want to address that specifically. But let me address the pleadings and the state of the pleadings and the 91A. 91A only provides a deadline for amending your pleading as to the challenged cause of action, period. And that's all it relates to. Here, we did not amend to the challenged cause of action, which was the Tort Claims Act. We did not amend that. What we did was we added the 1983 claims. The 1983 claims, we then went forward with the hearing, which was pretty quick, within a day or two after we filed the amended pleading on 1983. And so the 1983 claims were not before the court. And once we filed them under Rule 65, they become part of the live pleading. No motion to strike was filed. And so therefore, we believe that regardless of the issues as it pertains to the Tort Claims Act claims, we still have a valid 1983 claim that we've asserted, and we asserted it timely, arising out of the facts and circumstances of the case. And in addition, let me go back then, too, to talk for 1 second about the dismissal of Officer Winters. So far, the only pleadings, or if you even consider them evidence, or only thing in the record, let's say, on course and scope, as to Officer Winters, is we did make an alternative pleading. We did that. The reason we did that is we have not deposed everybody, and while we have deposed Officer Winters, and of course his deposition is not part of the record, we've deposed him, we've not deposed the City of Forest Hill, and so we don't know yet that the City of Forest Hill, what position will they take? Will they take the position, yes, he's in course and scope, or will they say, no, he's not, not when he's a licensed officer and he is handed a live handgun and he uses it. We don't know the position they'll take on that. Therefore, at this point, they have not sustained their burden to judicially admit or provide evidence he was in the course and scope. And it's difficult, I think, for them to rely on our pleadings as a judicial admission. Otherwise, if I could judicially admit people were in the course and scope, I would never have to fight course and scope. And that'd be a great case of the law, but that's not what the law is. And then finally, as I'm running out of time, I'll say this as well, that there are cases that we've cited that the 101-106 election of remedies does not preclude a plaintiff from asserting civil rights claims. That's the University of Texas Houston versus Rios case and the Texas Department of Aging versus Cannon. And is that the case that, the Justice, case you just missed, yes, that mentioned? I think that the question you may have posed, it may not be directly addressed in any of the briefing. We did pick up on that case for this proposition that a motion to dismiss under the Tort Claims Act cannot be used to dismiss a federal civil rights claim such as a 1983 claim. And that's the Texas Supreme Court.
Which is not what I recall the issue being in that case, but I'll go back and double check it.
Your Honor, I'm out of time. I appreciate the time with the court. We ask the court to affirm the orders of the trial court and let us go back down to the trial court to prepare the case for trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
With due respect, what I'm hearing is that if you're a small or medium-sized city without your own police department, and you don't have your own police department training academy, that you're not engaged in a governmental function by making sure your officers comply with state law to get the training that you then have to make sure they get and report to the state. And that just doesn't make sense, that cities with their own training academies are performing a governmental function, whereas a city that hires it out because it doesn't have the resources to have its own academy is not engaged in a governmental function. And back to what was said in the Butler case and to a lesser extent in the Doe case, it doesn't matter for performing a governmental function if you pay someone else to do it, if you make money off of it, or if you do it yourself, or if you have volunteers do it. So I think that that's just a path that doesn't need to be traveled very far. I would like to comment on the Schilling case that was decided by the Supreme Court in 1951. That was before the Texas legislature had a Tort Claims Act. The first Tort Claims Act was adopted, I believe, in 1972. It was heavily amended to add the laundry list of governmental functions in either 1987 or 1988. And the general flurry of cases that came out after the laundry list of 36 items was first adopted said, in general, it's presumed that a municipality is engaged in a governmental function, even if it's not one of the functions on this laundry list. And then you have the broad category of 101.0215A that basically says all of these things that aren't listed can be governmental functions for the reasons I've already explained. The Schilling case, again, decided several decades before there was a Tort Claims Act with a list of laundry list of functions, I don't think has any bearing on what we have here. This court, in both the Doe case and in the Texas Bay Cherry Hill case, if I can call it just Cherry Hill, I think that's what y'all have cited it as, focused on, is it related to, closely related to, or necessary to the governmental function? Training is necessary to the governmental function of police protection and control. You can't have a police officer who's not trained. You can't have an unlicensed officer. And as I said, to get and keep your license, you have to engage in and complete a training academy, and then every 2 years report a 40-hour block of time of ongoing TCOL-approved training, which includes this state-mandated active shooter training. We're not also, to deal with this issue about the alleged advertising and profit and so forth, I'd point you back to the Cherry Hill case. The city of Forest Hill is not being sued for its advertising. It's not being sued for any profit it made or didn't make. It's not being sued for how it spent any money it earned. It's being sued for a tragic accident that happened in a mandatory training class. That's a governmental function. Again, the discussion about profit, advertising, participating with this contractor who furnished the training is just simply a path that leads nowhere and certainly doesn't lead to proprietary function. In the Texas Bay Cherry Hill case, this court looked at some similar arguments as to whether something that a council member was sued for, comments that she made about this development partnership between the city of Forest Hill and a private entity, was related to the governmental function that was involved in redevelopment. And she basically, in her comments, was reiterating what the purpose of the program was, and that was considered to be performance of a governmental function. Here we have a tragic accident when both officers involved were in a training exercise. It's a governmental function. I actually have about 20 seconds left. Unless there's a question, I think I've commented on all of.
Yeah, on the 1983 issue, you know, that was not a part of your motion. Obviously, it wasn't entertained. You have the argument that it wasn't timely, but we're really limited in determining whether or not the trial court erred and denying the motion. So I mean, you still have a recourse to argue to the court that there was a timeliness problem, and you could file another motion if you needed to on the 1983 issues, correct?
Your Honor, the several cases that we cited in our briefing point to the language in Rule 91A that the court cannot consider any untimely motion. I'm sorry, untimely amendment. The cases recognize there's not a need to object to preserve that complaint. If it wasn't timely, it can't be considered under Rule 91A. Therefore, the ruling of the district court should have been to dismiss all timely claims asserted against Sergeant Winters, and that's what we're asking for.
Okay.
And that would, because the only timely claim was the tort claim, that the untimely amendment can't be considered and the whole case should therefore be dismissed.
I just have a comment. It's directed to both sides. I'm not trying to be a curmudgeon, but both sides were woefully deficient in your citation form, especially cases involving courts of appeal. The rules have a purpose in requiring things like the subsequent writ history of cases from the courts of appeal, because it does make a difference whether it's what the Supreme Court did with it, whether anybody asked for the Supreme Court to do anything with it, and we need to know that information. And if you go back and look at your briefs, for the most part, it's just not there. So in future briefing, please take that into consideration, because what you don't do, we have to do, and just makes our job that much harder. And we would appreciate it if you would kind of keep an eye on the rules of form for citation form, and you do that accordingly.
Well noted. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Wallet. Okay, your case has now been submitted. We appreciate your arguments and your presence here today, and you are now free to go. Thank you.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.